establishments or programs authorized by tribal governments on reservation land. Currently, there are 6,111 GRH approved settings. Over 4,300 of those are family adult foster care. The setting itself must have an agreement with the county in order to provide services under the GRH program. There is a GRH housing rate, which is used to pay for room and board on behalf of people living in those eligible settings. Currently, the maximum rate is $867 per month, depending on the person's income, but the average is $530 a month. There's also a personal needs allowance that's available on the program of $94 a month. If the individual is living in a setting that provides congregate meals, the person is not eligible for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which provides food support. The individual may also receive other services, including wraparound services provided by other mainstream programs under medical assistance rate waivers or GRH supplemental rates that I'll talk about in a moment. If the person is not able to access other payments or other services, they may receive a GRH supplemental rate in certain settings. The statewide standard is $459.85 a month. There is a state moratorium on new development of supplemental rate beds. And I should mention that the supplemental rate was reduced by the legislature in 2009 by 7.58%. In federal state fiscal year 2012, almost $122 million was spent in this program.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that number? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear it.
Yes, almost $122 million was spent in state fiscal year 2012.
Thank you.
The monthly average caseload is 18,200 people, either elderly or people with disabilities. And of that, about 17% are seniors or elderly.
Representative Isaacson.
Madam Chair, I think I heard this correctly, but did you say that your annual for budget for just this is $122 million? Is that what you said?
That's correct.
Okay. And that in fiscal year 2011, 18,200 people, elderly and, of that is, sorry, I misunderstood. I got it now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. There are not other questions?
Is that the conclusion of your testimony?
That's for that program. I was going to move on to the long-term homeless supported services.
I do have a question then.
Go ahead.
The $459 supplemental rate, that's a supplemental payment beyond the what you said was the other $867 per month?
That's correct. The $867 is to help pay for room and board. The supplemental service rate is to help pay for services that the individual needs that they're not able to access elsewhere, such as through a waiver program.
Does it also include personal care attendants at all? Are there ever personal care attendants in these settings?
No.
They're not...
No.
Ever in these settings?
No.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. The next...
excuse me. One more question here. Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Chair. The question I have is when we're talking supplemental rate, I heard 459, but that's been reduced. Is that correct? And what is the actual amount?
The current rate, Madam Chair, Representative, the current rate is $459.85. That is after the reduction that was occurred in 2009.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
Thank you. Representative Moran, did you have a question? Was there another question? Okay. Proceed.
Madam Chair, members, next I'd like to talk about long-term homeless supportive services. These are not dollars that go to housing per se, but these are dollars that go to for services. The long-term homeless supportive services grants were created by the legislature in 2005 to fund special supportive services that would assist single individuals, families, and youth experiencing long-term homelessness to find and maintain housing. The funding was designated as part of Minnesota's business plan for ending long-term homelessness at the time. In state fiscal year 2012, $5.2 million was provided to five projects throughout Minnesota, which cover 35 counties and five Indian reservations. The strategy behind these funds is to provide funding for any and all services that are needed to help a household escape homelessness, stay in housing, and achieve their goals. So supportive services might include case management, utility bill assistance, transportation assistance, or other crisis intervention. It's whatever the family needs to maintain and stay in housing. There are multi-county and tribal projects were given priority for funding. And local community nonprofits and government entities provide services at the local level. And just in terms of impact, for those served on the program, over half of the households were housed in scattered site supportive housing settings. One of five households, or about 23%, received earned income.
Thank you.
And 37% of the household had increased their income since entering the program, so that they were able to have some success with jobs when they had some stability in their housing. Of the households who left the program, almost half exited to permanent housing. That was 48%. And in 2012, there were 1,469 households who were served, which included 3,292 people. Almost 1,500 of those were children.
Excuse me, Ms. Aronson. Sullivanson, you know what? We don't have a document for this from you. Was there one available?
We do not have a fact sheet on this. One is being developed that we will provide to the committee. So the only fact sheet you have right now is on the group residential housing. So we will get that to you. And we can get you another document with all these numbers on it.
Yeah, that would be, I think it would be really helpful. So
we'd be glad to do that.
Have that information. I don't know if we can take notes fast enough from to under.
We'll be glad to do that. We can do that in a pretty timely fashion. So,
thank you.
To refresh your recollection, one out of every eight households was headed by a person 21 years of age or younger. So you can see this is a pretty young population. Part of the success of this program is almost 60% of the households were living without a permanent home for over a year before the program, and 10% were homeless for the last 6 years. We're really targeting those most in need. And over 70% of the participants were persons of color. And half had a disability for a long duration. So again, these are very hard to serve individuals. Again, we'll get you this data. The next program I'm going to talk about.
Wait a minute, just excuse me. If you don't mind, it seems to work well to just have a question after each program. Any questions? Representative Herzog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious with regard to the statistics that you've been providing to us, if there is a consistent metric of what homelessness is in terms of how you define that. Is that for a month, 2 months, 6 months?
Ms. Sutton.
Madam Chair, Representative, these were individuals who were experiencing long-term homelessness, and I believe that was homelessness for over a year. Get some assistance here just to make sure I'm accurate.
It's
introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Jane Lorenz, work at the Department of Human Services for Aaron. So the definition of long-term homelessness is homelessness for 1 year or longer, or four episodes in 3 years.
Thank you.
And thanks for that clarification. And if I'm not mistaken, I mean, it's exclusive to those individuals to meet that term. So others who are not homeless for that long or do not have those episodes are not allowed into this program.
That's correct.
Thank you. Go ahead, proceed. Any other questions regarding this? I guess just one other. This was an initiative that Governor Pawlenty brought forward. Is that correct?
That's correct. This was part of the plan to end long-term homelessness.
Yeah. And how many years have we had this program in existence?
2005 it was created.
And I think some of the data that we'll be looking forward in the documents you're going to give us are the percentage of people who succeeded in this program, in other words, who the program actually helped. I was only able to write down one number, that you had 48% leave the program. Does that mean they went into what kind of housing afterwards?
To some sort of permanent housing.
Permanent housing?
Yes.
Okay. and the duration of time that they can be in long-term homeless housing is how long? How long are they allowed to be in this program? Maybe Ms. Lorenz can clarify that again.
They can be in the program as long as they need the services. There's no end date.
No end date. Okay. That's Ms. Lorenz for the tape.
Thank you.
Any other question? Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, the next program I want to talk about is called the Healthy Transition to Adult and Homeless Prevention Program. This is one that I will get you some additional data on. We don't have a handout for this either. But this program is directed at Minnesota youth who are aged is 14 to 20 who are in out-of-home placement for a year and a half or longer and who face the prospect of leaving foster care without a permanent legal family. About, just so you know, about 500 kids leave each year under these conditions from foster care. And as you might imagine, outcomes for kids who don't have permanency as they exit foster care are very grim. In 2005, the legislature appropriated $4.34 million over 4 years to assist youth in out-of-home placement with intensive independent living skills, as well as to provide support services to youth age 18 or older who experience an out-of-home placement since they were age 16. We use those funds along with about $700,000 in federal independent living funds to put together a combined package of federal and state dollars to contract with community-based agencies to provide services, and including housing services, for youth who are either exiting foster care or who had been in foster care. We currently have performance-based contracts with 25 community agencies throughout the state. In 63% of the funding in this program goes to providers in greater Minnesota, and about 37% of the funding goes to providers in the metropolitan area. This program is centered on based on outcome goals that are part of the federal and state requirements for children who are transitioning from foster care to independence, and so the work and work in this area and goals are aligned, and the work with the agencies is done in concert with county agencies to try to help make sure kids have the what they need when they transition. And I'm going to give you just a little bit of information about who the youth are served in this program. In 2011, throughout the state, there were 1,100 youth who were either in care or who had left foster care who were served in this program. And during that year, the grant providers served 302 youth who were still in foster care. There was an even split between males and females. Most of the kids were aged 16 and 17, although there were a few 18-year-olds as well. And about 60% of the individuals who were served in foster care were Caucasian, about 17% were Indian children, and almost 9% were African American children. During that same year, agencies provided services to almost 800 youth who had left care. And again, these are kids who had left care and were either homeless or at risk of homeless. Again, a combination of pretty equal between males and females. The youth in this area were between ages 18 and 20, a pretty even split in those categories. Again, those are the ages that youth, all youth are, of course, particularly vulnerable, particularly youth who exit foster care without permanent resources. So that's a fairly new program. But it is one that's targeted to adolescents. That's unlike the other two that I mentioned. And again, we'll get you more data on that in handwritten form.
Okay. Ms. Sullivan Sutton, we do have a document before us. It's called Healthy Transition to Adulthood and Homeless Prevention Program. But as you were giving the demographics, I think you were giving them for 2011, and the ones I see on here are for 2012, and the numbers seem significantly different. Has there been some changes in the program?
I'm going to ask Steve Vondahar to join me.
I If you'd introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the document we handed out was the updated for 2000.
Excuse me, could you just introduce yourself for the tape? Thank you.
Vonderhart.
Mr. Vonderhart.
I supervise adolescent services at Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Okay, so what you handed out was an updated version, and I noticed that some significant changes in the demographics. I didn't get it in time to compare all of the things that were being said, but have there been significant changes?
Some of the changes is there's fewer kids served, slightly fewer kids served. We think that's kind of an attribute of fewer kids actually in foster care. That foster care rate is going down somewhat. That might be part of it.
Can you give me a percentage, Mr. Vanderbilt?
So in the last approximately 10 years, the number of kids in foster care in general has been reduced by about 40%.
And
that's all ages.
And Ms. Solomon Sutton, what would you attribute that to?
Madam Chair, members, would attribute that to a number of things. First, on the front end of child protection, we and the counties have worked very hard to provide early intervention and family engagement services to keep kids safely at home with services provided whenever that's possible. Also, on the other end, when kids do in fact need out-of-home placement, there's been a lot of work to assure that they have permanency in their lives, preferably by being reunified with their families if that's safe to do so, and if that's not possible in a timely fashion, to help find permanent legal families for those children, either by having permanent custody transferred to a relative or being adopted by another family. And we have seen a reduction in the amount of time for kids who stay in foster care because they are achieving permanency.
Okay. Questions from other committee members? Okay, and so the appropriation for this, 1.777 is the total of both the state and the federal, if I'm understanding that correctly. And
yeah, Madam Chair, the base amount is $1,065,000, and then we combine that with 712,267 federal CHAFE funds.
And what are the federal CHAFE funds applicable to? Are they, do you get to use them for any of the services, or are there limitations on
those?
There
are limitations to those, Madam Chair. Those funds are under Title 4E of the Social Security Act, and they are intended to be directed to independent living services for eligible youth who've been in foster care.
And this the state funding as of the last biennium, how did that compare to the previous biennium?
The original appropriation was $1,085,000.
Okay.
And I believe it was 2009 that it was cut.
Okay. And in the governor's budget now, can you tell us what the number is?
The governor's budget Seven. That was released yesterday does not recommend any changes to this program.
So it continues to be at 1.777. 1.065. Yeah, correct.
Okay.
And have the federal funds continued to be the same, or are they increased or diminished?
The federal funds, because they are tied to the foster care rate, the number of children in foster care nationwide, they've gone down almost every year.
Okay. Somewhat. And just the last question I ask is do we have adequate funding in this program to fund the needs of the children who are in need of this healthy transition to adulthood, homeless prevention? Or are there children who are not being served?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what we've seen recently, especially with the economy, a lot of the youth are unable to obtain jobs, and that's kind of the number one thing that youth have to have in order to get into housing. These programs help with supportive housing. And so many of the youth, I think there's still quite a need out there, especially now in this economy, for these programs, because not only they focus very little on housing, but mostly the focus is on independent living. And obviously there's many aspects of independent living aside from having housing that youth need to pursue.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Sutton.
One other thing I would add, although it's not within the purview of your committee, I think it's important to note that the federal law changed a couple of years ago to allow for kids to remain in foster care until they're 18, from 18 to 21. And as a part of that, the federal foster care funds can be used to help support kids pursuing post-secondary education. And so one of the positive things that we are seeing is an increase in the number of children remaining in foster care who are actually able to pursue post-secondary education, was something we literally did not see just a few years ago. So we have some hope that there's other resources available to help support these kids becoming self-sufficient into adulthood.
I would be interested in the numbers. If you can at some point tell us what that percentage is, that would be helpful. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. I really appreciate it. I realize the governor's budget is still brand new, but I do have a couple questions related to following up with the chair had referred to, and my understanding and statistics that I've seen from different places talks about how homelessness has not, we're still increasing the population in some ways, of especially with youth homelessness over the last few years, and I'm a little concerned with something I heard where we talk about the idea that the governor's budget has not really changed, it's offering the same amount, yet the problem still increases. And so, in that light, I'd ask again, do we have the resources being dedicated to that necessary to help us handle that problem in a meaningful way?
Ms. Sutton.
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, let me clarify. When I said the governor's budget does not change, does not recommend an increase or decrease for that particular program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
That is not to say that you will not hear from many, that there continues to be a need in the state for serving homeless youth.
Right. So,
Representative Isaacson.
Would you say that, it is my understanding from looking at the budget that I don't see a significant increase at all across the board in terms of dealing with housing and homelessness. Am I right about that, or is it about static the same, or did I miss something?
Sullivan Sutton.
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, I can only speak to the Human Services budget, but
you
are correct with respect to that.
You're absolutely correct. Thank you for pointing that out. I meant Human Services budget. And so, Madam Chair.
Representative Isaacson,
thank you. I'm still getting used to this.
That's okay. I am too.
And so when we're looking at the continued problem, and especially what I would say is growing problem of youth homelessness, and we're not looking at perhaps providing the resources we need, or at least it seems that way, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot with the governor, but I'm wondering, I'm concerned that we're not providing the resources necessary to manage this problem in a healthy way that helps us at least work towards some resolution of it, rather than just a maintenance going through. And I realize it's a complicated issue with just so many factors, and youth homelessness is even harder to detect and measure than adult homelessness. But, can you speak to where we're at in terms of managing some of that with the current funding we have, and could we be doing better? That's a leading question. Let me rephrase that, because of course we could be doing better. What could we be doing better?
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, there is, as mentioned, some money in the budget for the supportive services for this population.
Mm-hmm.
We also have some money where we're administering the Runaway and Homeless Youth
Great.
Act.
Yeah.
I believe that's about $2 million. It's a small amount.
Mm-hmm.
It is less than what you will hear from advocates in terms
sure.
of what is needed.
Sure.
And we know that there continue to be youth who are throughout the state, not just in the metro area, that who need access to services.
And if we were to look at the idea of expanding, thank you very much. If we were to look at the idea of maybe expanding that area of the budget, would that be a prudent use? It could be put to good use in terms of being able to help address a larger population of homeless youth, or what would you say?
Is that
Madam Chair, Representative, that certainly is an important question for the legislature to answer. I can say that there is a need. I had a meeting this morning with some folks who are working in the Rochester area in Olmsted County and are doing some work with respect to homelessness, and they have seen some significant need in that community alone, but I know that's true elsewhere.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Warren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think my question, Commissioner, is pretty much around the Chair's statement and also Representative Isaacson. We know in looking at, and I'm really glad that the department is finding ways to decrease the transitional for kids who are in foster care and out of home placement to enter into society, you know, with some skills. But we also know in a large numbers there are a huge amount of kids who are in the child welfare system who is in out of home placement, who is in foster care, who do not get the support they need to transition out, and they're finding themselves homeless or incarcerated. And I also know that the department is looking at a strength-based model where you're looking at how to keep kids, if by all means, in their home with their family, because we know kids thrive best when they are connected to a productive parent. And you're on a path to create that and help create stronger communities and stronger families through that process. And so when I look at the state fiscal year 2012, where a grantee served 584 youth, which I think is so small with the population that is in foster care and out of home placement who are aging out with the possibility of becoming homeless, along the lines of the question or the statement that Representative Iason made, is that there's a need. There's a need to support more kids who are transitioning out of foster care, where they are employed, where they have the tools they need to be productive citizens. So my hope is that, you know, as we look at, and I guess this is not a question, this is more of a statement, but as we look at how to transition our young adults from 18, and again, looking at the federal law that says we're moving them 9 from 18, we're not just going to just put you out there in society. We're going to continue to support you to the age of 21, that we need to find a need to support children who have gone through a system sometimes for many, many, many years without a stable home and a stable environment from foster home to foster home, that at the end of that 18 years or 21 days, they're able to transition back out into the community to be productive citizens. My hope is that in a year or two or three or four, the 584 youth that we are seeing is two or three times that amount, or even better, that we are keeping kids with their families, if at all possible.
Madam Chair,
Ms.
Representative, you raised several excellent points. And in addition to serving these kids who are transitioning, what we are seeing for the first time is an increase in the number of kids who remain in care between the ages of 18 and 21 who are availing themselves of services. And I expect that we will continue to see that number increase over time as more and more counties are serving that population. And you also mentioned the work that we are doing and the governor has proposed to support families before out-of-home placement is needed, and the governor did recommend an appropriation of about $4.5 million to have a statewide expansion of a very proven, effective early intervention program known as the Parent Support Outreach Program that's currently available in 38 counties and has been proven to reduce maltreatment, and so we were pleased to see that.
Thank you. I just want to clarify on that last. The $4.5 million recommended for, you said, for parent support outreach?
Yes, for the buy-in.
And it's because right now most of that, did you say, is going to Greater Minnesota?
Currently,
or needs to go to Greater Minnesota?
The Parent Support Outreach Program is an early intervention program that was first piloted in Minnesota in 2005. Mm-hmm. It was based on what we learned in the early reform of our state's child protection system. It is a engagement and outreach for families who are reported to child protection, but on that given day, their situation isn't bad enough to be brought into the child protection system. But on a voluntary basis, the agency makes an outreach offer to the family, talks to them about issues of safety and whether services are needed. What we found in the pilot and continues today are these are families who generally are in extreme poverty, may have some issues with disabilities or chemical dependency, And if given the opportunity, they tend to avail themselves of services without the threat of losing their children. And that program was evaluated by the Institute of Applied Research out of St. Louis, Missouri. And what the evaluation clearly showed is that for families in poverty who receive services, the outcome for them is much better than similar families without services. And so we've been trying to maintain that pilot infrastructure for the past several years, and this is an attempt to provide that opportunity for services for families throughout the state.
Okay, thank you very much. I have, Representative Hertel, I think you've had a chance. Did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question regarding some of the benefits that you've been describing in the different programs. I'm curious with regard to the caseload and the participants of the program. Is there a maximum benefit to these individuals? Is there some type of system in which you know, they're encouraged to lift themselves up out of this dependency, or is the support there? I think initially when we first started talking about this, you're talking about 18,000 people receiving a benefit or whatnot. Does that sunset for the individual at any time, or is there a minimum period or maximum benefit? I'm just curious.
Listen.
Madam Chair, Representative, you ask what sounds like a very simple question, and yet it's very complex. It depends on the program. So, for example, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, there are time limits of 60 months unless there are certain exceptions. Under the Group Residential Housing Program, which is the first program I mentioned today, people are eligible as long as they are eligible, and these are people who are eligible, as I said, because of disability. They're either eligible for general assistance or SSI and are blind, aged, or disabled, and so as long as they are eligible. Many of these people do work, however, and they contribute to the cost of their care as well.
Madam Chair?
Representative Hertel?
Just clarification, did you say 16 months or 60?
60 months.
6-0.
6-0.
Okay.
Most people exit the program within 2 years.
That's helpful to know that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Isaacson, I believe you.
Chair, Madam Chair, yep. Just thinking this out. Just in terms of following up with the representative's question, what percentage of your overall population is served in the terms of the long-term, where they're blind or disabled and possibly working for themselves and living in that scenario? Do you have an idea of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Isaac said I don't have that with me.
Okay,
with
that's fair. I want to be clear because you used the word dependent, and I want to hit on that for a second, that there's a connotation that goes with that word, and I want to be clear that we're not talking about people that are there out of choice for themselves. It's a need that needs to go on there, and so I'm just careful with that word, what that means, and the connotations that come along with it. When you're talking about people that have disabilities and are elderly that are trying to take care of themselves, versus people I think you're rightfully referring to, where it's a matter of getting them back up on their feet. And so I just hope that that's clear. The second question I have is this. You know, understanding the nature, especially with youth homelessness, that the more we do to support them when they're younger, the less money, I mean, to be cold about it, the less money we're spending on them later when they're in society as taxpaying members. Not to mention, of course, the more important part of having a more fulfilled life because they were able to get back on track. And then that really has been a proven thing that I've seen carried out in education and housing and all that stuff. And then seeing the increase that we're seeing in some of the homeless youth, why is it that the governor didn't propose more money, do you suppose? Or can you speak to that at all, why we wouldn't be seeing an increase in funding in that area?
Listen,
Madam Chair, Representative, I can't answer that.
Fair enough. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I think Representative Fisher and then Moran, is that right? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions I have. One is when I was hearing a little bit before on the group residential housing, we were talking about people receiving support from there. When people are earning income in that, if they have a job, are they losing benefits at a ratio of for every dollar they earn, they lose $1 benefits, or is there a scaling where they come off of that?
Hopefully we'll get a little help here. Ms. Lorenz.
Madam Chair, Representative, basically it's a dollar-for-dollar loss. It can get a little complicated at times depending on the program they're on, but that's essentially what it is.
Representative Fisher?
Thank you. Thank you. And then I've got one other question or clarification when we were talking about money for homeless youth addressing it. As I know the one portion that we were looking at right here is for the foster care, but I do know that the Runaway Homeless Youth Act is a separate dollar amount. Was that something that we're also going to be covering today, or is that different? And the reason I ask is I serve like two different populations, so I just want to get some clarification in that area if possible.
Madam Chair, Representative, I had not planned to cover that today, but we can get you more information on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
And that along with the other data.
Okay, yeah, I appreciate that. And if there are other programs within the agency that should be covered too, could you tell me what they are? Because we want to make sure we cover them all in this housing committee that relate to housing.
Madam Chair, I think we've covered it.
Except for the homeless.
Yeah, and any, but I don't know if you've looked at any services in the disability area. I don't know if there's any others or not, but I can go back and check with the other areas of the department and get back to you if there are.
Appreciate that. You know, one of the things that happens here is every committee has different budgets, and we're kind of in little silos, but I'm really hoping one thing we can do in this committee in terms of the issue of housing is try to understand the interconnections, and there's several different agencies that feed into the homelessness and housing, affordable housing issues. So we're trying to make sure we hit all of them, and we don't want to miss any programs because it'll help us make good decisions as we get towards the budget. So thank you. Any other, did we get everybody's questions, comments here? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Moran, I called on you and
I'll
give you a chance
Chair.
Back again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, based on the population of African Americans in Native American in the state of Minnesota, I believe they are disproportionately a part of the foster care system. And so, in looking over your numbers here and looking at the parent support outreach program and the services that are being provided, can you just explain to me why there's 58% of the youth who are receiving services are Caucasian and only 12% African American Indians and 8.6% being Black or African American, based on the disproportionality of them being a part of the system?
Representative Moran, I'm going to ask Steve to come back and join us. And the question has to do with the runaway or the healthy transitions and why the majority of those children are.
Mr. Vanderfest.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Moran, the numbers that you're looking at, they're broken down by number of youth in foster care, and then the bottom part is youth who left foster care. I can't necessarily explain it today, but you'll notice that the African-American youth served who had left foster care was 36%. Yeah, and so I believe that the African-American youth that are being served while in foster care one assumption would be they're being served well by the foster care, and it's not until they leave the foster care system that they seek community services and some of the providers that we fund. That would be one scenario to investigate in that regard.
And we can get you more data from the grantees.
So the
hope is to... Representative Moran?
Thank you. So I guess the hope is to continue to get more services, more grantees, or more funding to support more of their populations.
Mr. Benefest?
That would, Madam Chair, Representative Moran. Yes, and I would add to that, making sure that we fund community-based organizations that are designed and have the capacity to serve populations is one of our goals as well.
Thank you.
Representative Moran. All right. Thank you. And we will have some time, I think, at the end when we, after we have hear from the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, if we have time, if there are others in the audience who want to provide some testimony. We've only heard from the agency directly. So thank you so much. I appreciate your being here. Okay. So the next presentation is by by NARO. National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. Welcome to the committee. And
thank
if you. Just introduce yourself, please.
Good afternoon. Are our levies?
This is an important source for HRAs, especially those that oversee projects and redevelopment. And in addition, HRA levy dollars, in addition to project specific, have also been used to supplement our decreasing federally funded programs. HRAs can levy up to 0.0185% of the previous year's taxable market value. It's currently very underutilized in greater Minnesota, where there's a capacity of about $21 million that HRAs can levy. Only about $5.5 million is levied. What is affordable housing? Affordable housing is generally defined as paying less than 30% of your income towards your housing costs. I say that generally because, of course, a lot of programs have different affordability requirements. So now I'm going to get in a little bit about today's market and our context and current trends, and then I'm going to turn it over to Deanna, who's going to talk about specific programs. So the first chart, titled Proportion of Households Paying 30% or More of Income for Housing. This chart shows that percentage or the proportion of those people who are paying more than 30% of their income towards housing. You can see those at or below $50,000 income annually. Renters pay, about 66% of our renters in the state of Minnesota are paying more than 30% of their income towards rent. And about 54% of our homeowners in the state of Minnesota are paying more than 30% of their income towards rent. As you see, as the income goes above $50,000 annually, that becomes much more affordable for our Minnesotans. Unemployment and poverty. In 2010, 11.5% of the people in Minnesota were living in poverty. The average unemployment rate in Minnesota was 5.7% in June of 2012. But that number is really hard to track, and it doesn't include those who have quit actively looking for work. In addition, our homeless population has increased 25% from 2006 to 2009. The next chart, unemployment rate in Minnesota and in the U.S. As I mentioned, the number of unemployed is a very hard number to track. Nationwide, about 8.5% are unemployed. Compared to Minnesota, where about 5.7% are unemployed. However, estimates show that those numbers are 16% nationwide and 12% within the state of Minnesota. Homeownership in Minnesota. Median home sales price for the non-foreclosed homes in 2011 was about $166,418. This is a decrease of 18% since 2006. From 2005 to 2011, 134,315 foreclosures. Of these, 21,300 occurred in 2011 alone. Almost 1 in 5, or 18% of Minnesota mortgage holders owe more on their home than their home is worth. And about 5% of the primary mortgages in Minnesota were delinquent by 60 days or more in early 2012. As a comparison, from 1979 to 2004, this delinquency rate averaged 1.7%. The next chart you see is a map of the foreclosed or bank-owned loans throughout the state of Minnesota. As you can see, foreclosure has impacted the state of Minnesota statewide. You can see that there are some concentrations in the collar communities. The next chart shows, or map shows, delinquent loans in June of 2011. Again, you see that delinquent loans are represented throughout the state of Minnesota, again, concentrated within the collar communities. The foreclosure crisis has also had a huge impact on rental housing. On average, a two-bedroom apartment at fair market rent costs about $806 per month. In Minnesota, income for a typical renter has fallen 19% since 1999. Over 135,000 renters, households pay at least half of their income towards their rent. And the construction of multifamily apartments has is at a 50-year low.
Can I just interrupt for a second?
Yes.
You use the word collar communities. Can you define what that means?
Collar communities meaning around the metro.
Just around the seven?
Yep.
Yeah, I know. I just wanted to understand what it meant for sure. So it's the collar around the metro, Seven County metro area. Thank you.
The vacancy rate in 2009 for rental property peaked at about 7.5% and has now dropped to about 2.3% in 2011. A healthy rental market is about 5% vacancy, so you can see we're about half that right now. So Economics 101, supply and demand. As the supply decreases, rents increase, which is reflected in the chart titled Average Market Rents, Twin Cities Metro Rising Again. So back to the chart of people and what they're paying towards their housing costs. If you look at the chart titled Proportion of Households Paying 30% or More of Income and for Housing in Minnesota, those who are making less than $20,000 a year pay about 85% of those making $20,000 a year pay more than 30% of their income towards rent. Those earning between $20,000 and $35,000, about 62% of those pay more than 30% of their income towards rent. So now I'm going to turn it over to Deanna Bakken, who's going to talk about specific programs that HRAs have.
Welcome to the committee.
Committee members. My name is Deanna Bakken, as I said, with the Jackson, Windham, and Mountain Lake Housing and Redevelopment Authorities. Each HRA works in a different community, and we respond to our priorities separately per community. As a result, each HRA has a portfolio that addresses the local needs of each community. In the following presentation slides, I'm going to go into a little bit more detail of what some of our day-to-day programs are. The public housing program is the largest majority of what Minnesota NARO represents. HRAs own and manage this public asset. We have a high expertise in property management, and we do a lot of management for other properties within our communities. In addition to other HRAs, sometimes we're taking care of other properties that are not publicly owned. The tenant screening and management process is something that we spend a lot of time in and we're graded on regularly. We are funded and monitored by HUD, which is Housing and Urban Development. And in 2012, HUD rated our reserves and offset our subsidies. This resulted in many HRAs receiving absolutely zero income for the 2012 fiscal year with which we had to run our programs. This had a large impact on small agencies, many of which received zero income to run our programs and to subsidize the families that we serve. The next slide has a map on it of the cities with public housing by county. As you can see, just about every county in the state of Minnesota is represented by public housing authorities. Most of you have a housing authority in your district back home. And we encourage you to get to know them if you have any questions and use us as a resource if there's anything we can do to help with your questions. The households we serve in public housing, over 21,000 are very low-income households. Nearly 75% of public housing residents have an annual income under $15,000. 64% of our households are headed by seniors or those with disabilities. One third of the public housing residents are children, and many of them are homeless or at risk of being homeless. We also serve a large number of veterans, and there is a misperception as to who it is we serve. The elderly, the disabled, the veterans, and the children are who we see day to day. The Housing Choice Voucher Program is an example of the public and private partnership with our landlords in our communities. The subsidy also provides an economic impact in all of our communities back home. It is also funded and monitored by HUD. And in 2012, the administration fees were significantly reduced, funded at only 73%. These percentages I'm sharing with you What that means is they calculate exactly how much money we need to fund our programs and to run our programs, and then they give us 73% of that. It makes a challenge to continue to move forward and provide services when the federal government makes it a little bit more challenging and unique of a job for us. The households we serve with the Housing Choice Voucher Program, the map on the left is the rural development and Section 8, which is also throughout the entire state. I wanted to draw your attention to that because also back home you have plenty of HRAs that would be happy to help you with any questions you have about those programs that don't get answered today. Again, the households we serve in the Housing Choice Voucher Program, there's approximately 32,000 households served by these privately owned subsidized units. The median household income for the Section 8 program is $20,000 annually. Approximately 50% of the units are housed by elderly and 50% are housed by families. Over 92% of the HRAs have waiting lists that exceed 3 years, especially in the metro areas. Many of those waiting lists close for years at a time. When reopened, they receive tens of thousands of applicants within a matter of days because the need is so high and the subsidy is so short. The Rural Development Program has 10,000 units across the state of Minnesota. They're privately owned properties, often built in the 70s and functionally obsolete. Many of the properties are comprised of 8 to 16 units with partial rental subsidy. They're very small properties scattered throughout greater Minnesota. Minnesota is on the leading edge of preserving these highly distressed properties. There was not much of a push at the national level, and Minnesota has been working with our national agency very, very closely to help get some recognition for the needs of these special properties. Some of the community development programs that we work with are the rehabilitation programs, home ownership initiatives, we do innovative partnerships, and the primary funding streams include DEED, MHFA, and CDBG. The fiscal impact on HRAs, the federal and state budget constraints limit already scarce resources. The increased complexity of the services for very low incomes and households. There are a number of our tenants and our clients who are working with multiple different agencies to receive multiple different services, and the complexity of it becomes more and more challenging. Those with mental service needs, many of our veterans, when the programs overlap, quite often the rules and the understanding of what's needed for one program to the next does not overlap. While our budgets continue to be cut, our expectations of services and needs for our clients continues to grow. And the bonds for the housing is also a very important resource to us. Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has provided a number of different public housing agencies in the last few years with redevelopment grants and opportunities, and the Jackson Housing Authority was one of the agencies to receive some of those funds. With that, we demoed all of our boiler heating system and put in geothermal for our building. Not only is this an economic energy preservation, but it also helps the longevity of our building. The building itself is the envelope, and by preserving the heat and cooling temperature of the inside, it preserves the building long term. It's also a good opportunity to reduce our carbon footprint. The long-term future expenses will also be reduced, and this project was one-third funded by HUD at the federal level and two-thirds funded by Minnesota Housing. The 2013 state policy priorities of Minnesota NARO include increased state appropriations for affordable housing and community development, $50 million in bonding for affordable housing, and technical revision of homestead exclusion. Everything that we do at our agencies represents a partnership. It also represents a lot of creativity. As each day goes by and each fiscal dollar gets squeezed more, we have to become more creative and work together even more closely to continue to run our programs and take care of our clients in an appropriate manner. We have local board of directors that help give direction and policy decisions to all of us staff to carry out. We work closely with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency on state programs to help with affordable housing and redevelopment efforts, and we support the redevelopment programs of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Finally, much of what we do requires ongoing support from federal programs administered by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. With respect to our state partnership, we have consistently supported the Challenge Program administered by the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. We've also worked with the agency on bonding requests to provide funding for public housing rehabilitation. There's a significant backlog of rehab projects that are needed at public housing facilities across the state of Minnesota. We've made very good use to maintain our housing infrastructure, and we will look forward to working with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and all of you to ensure that the housing safety net stays in place in Minnesota. With that, Madam Chair, Jennifer and I would stand for any questions from you or the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Is it Bakken or Bakken?
Bakken.
Bakken, okay. I'm sure there'll be some questions from committee members. Maybe we'll start Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question, I believe it's Jennifer.
Yes.
First Lady, thank you. We've kind of talked about HRAs in abstract, and my question has to do with HRA's levy authority. Levy authorities can sometimes be controversial or problematic. In your boards, are they elected or appointed? How are your boards selected in relation to that levy authority?
Madam Chair, Representative, it is actually laid out in state statute in 469. Our boards are appointed by the mayor and confirmed by the council. In the case of the Brainerd HRA, for the Crow Wing County HRA, the county board appoints board members.
Representative Anderson, follow. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is for Ms. Bakken. On the rural development program, when the point about the privately owned properties often built in the 70s being functionally obsolete, could you tell me a little bit about what the definition of functionally obsolete is, what that means, and who determines what that is?
Ms. Bakken.
Madam Chair, Committee Schumacher.
Yes.
The properties were, the vast majority of them were built at the same time, and most of the properties did not have a maintenance plan or an upkeep capital plan. Therefore, the structures and the maintenance schedule has not been up to date. The structures themselves are starting to need repair. The windows, the roofs, the heating elements, all of the general structures of the properties are kind of deteriorating at the same time because they were built around the same time and not had maintenance since. There has been a number of research surveys and information, much of which was handled through the Minnesota Housing Partnership, to get more information about the specific needs at each of those properties, and that's where the information came from. Does that cover your question?
Ms. Schumacher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, that helps that along. With new construction now, are there plans in place for maintenance and that sort of thing so we don't see this as a continual issue, or is that still a challenge?
Ms. Berwin? Bakken, either one of you?
I'll address it first, and then okay. Deanna may have some things to add on to. Let me just first say about public housing. Public housing from the federal government, we do get what's called a capital fund Our capital fund dollars have been significantly cut thanks to the state of Minnesota and the bond issue. We were able to supplement our capital funds to do some improvements to our public housing. Our public housing properties, we have to do a capital improvement plan every year to take a look at our properties and make sure that we're keeping them up. New construction of multifamily, there has been very little. I think with rural development properties, they generate so little in income, and they've just been a problem. I think the more current properties or more modern properties, we're building in those plans to our programs.
Madam Chair, the rural development program is not doing a lot of new developments, and thus where I was stumped because I wasn't sure if there was any new developments going up in the rural development program itself. There are some few and far between, and likewise, whether it's public housing, rural development, or any of the other development that takes place, that was something that was recognized, is we need to have those 5-year, 10-year, 20-year plans. And so, similar to the rural development program, many of the public housing agencies were created about around the same time. The public housing was created around the same time, and the federal government recognized about 10 years ago that things are starting to really fall apart at the same time, and really put a focus on understanding what our capital needs are, doing needs assessments, and coming up with a good plan of action. Unfortunately, keeping up with by them waiting so long to come up with this plan and this recognizing the issue kind of put us a little bit behind the ball. But the agencies are continuing to, and this is with the properties that we have, continuing to recognize what's the most important features of what kind of maintenance is going to be needed in the near future. So like some of the new development, also the ones that we manage currently, it is a priority now that it wasn't previously.
Representative Pertel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You identified that there is little or no new construction going on with HRAs. With the levy authority and the ability to raise funds through levy, is there some other impediments that are in place that are prohibiting some of these things from happening? Is there a lack of neighborhood or county or social will in terms of supporting the levy? Is there zoning restrictions, or are there other impediments, development standards, or the like, of which are preventing you from providing your mission?
You want to start it? Or you want me to start
Ms. Bergman?
It?
Madam Chair, Representative
Pertas.
Thank you. Maybe I'll start with public housing. As far as construction of new housing, there has not been any dollars allocated to the construction of new public housing in many years. Tax credit projects are being built throughout the state of Minnesota. I think there's been a lull in that. Tax credit allocations were down, and there are some tax credit projects that are being constructed. As far as using levy dollars to construct, I can only speak on behalf of the city of Brainerd and what we levy. We do levy at our full potential, which is the 0.0185% of last year's taxable market value. That comes, in 2012, our levy was $135,000. That dropped in 2013 to $108,000. With the significant cuts that we've seen in both public housing and in Section 8, we've had to use that levy money to supplement our existing programs. And for us to construct new housing right now, you know, when we're really having to tie in all of our resources to just maintain what we have, for the HRA in Brainerd, at least, it becomes very difficult.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Bakken.
Committee, the variety of different programs administered by Department of Economic Deed, MHFA, and some of the programs we were specifically referring to earlier are some of the tools that we have available to us in addition to the levies. And it really takes a partnership of a number of different opportunities to create new development and to do the rehabilitation on our properties as well. Those programs that we discussed earlier are the tools that we need to continue to move forward in potential development. But it usually takes the whole community to pull together to create some of those developments and to make things happen. A levy is one of the many tools in the toolbox that's available, but you really need to use many of them to accomplish.
Mr. Dust?
Madam Chair, thank you for that answer. I just was hoping that I would hear something a little bit different, because here in the metro, obviously, restrictive land use and development policies drive up the price of land, which is a major component of providing housing if it's new construction. So I was hoping to hear that in more rural areas in greater Minnesota, that there would be opportunities to provide affordable housing that would be commensurate with the changing cost of living in greater Minnesota because of lower land prices. Thank you.
Representative Green.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, you've stated there is no new construction, but I'm aware of at least a few buildings that have been purchased and renovated, and so the public housing in many areas of greater Minnesota has increased. As far as the upkeep on these goes, I would like some numbers on that as to what it costs to not just normally maintain them, but is there excess damage to these buildings? That's what I've heard from some of my constituents, that on a county level, when the county has to go in, that sometimes the repairs get to be very excessive, and they can repair these units, and not just the public housing units, but also the rental properties that HUD subsidizes, and 6 months later they have to repair them again. Can you comment on some of that?
Madam Chair?
Ms. Bakken.
Committee, I'm going to address the first statement that you made was about the new properties that are being renovated and for public housing. HUD gives each housing authority a number of ACC units, and we live in a world of acronyms. I'm trying to remember what all of them mean. I apologize. The number of units that you have doesn't change. That becomes your permanent number. If you're seeing properties being renovated, it's because they've lost other properties, whether it was to demolition, to fire, whatever, tornadoes that have come through. We live kind of down in Tornado Alley, so that happens on occasion. What they're doing is they're replacing those units one for one, but HUD has not expanded on our numbers. So what you see, and what we were saying about the numbers not changing in public housing specifically, is consistent. The next was the programs, because of some of the expectations and the rules we have to follow, it does make maintaining the properties a little bit more challenging than necessarily the average landlord. We do have to keep them up to standards. We get inspected regularly, and yes, occasionally we have the tenant that comes through and really does a number on the place. Private landlords have that. Public landlords have that. I don't think it's a disproportionate number, but it is a requirement that we get it up and back up to standards much quicker than anyone in the private market, I believe. We also have an expectation of maintaining things at a high level, but also an example would be bed bugs. In the private market, there's a lot of landlords that don't pay for cleaning up a unit that's been contaminated with bed bugs. in our properties, we're responsible for that expense. And there have been some agencies that have paid up to $25,000 in the last 2 years to eliminate bed bugs within their housing authority, because once you have a breakout, you have they travel very quickly. And the way the properties were designed, it sometimes is a challenge to stop a spread like that. That's an expense that we take on because we have to, but it's also something that we don't get reimbursed for out of our subsidies.
Thank you.
Madam
Representative O'Neill?
Madam Chair?
Oh, excuse me, Ms. Bergman.
If I may,
sure.
Representative Green, two things, I guess, maybe to address to your questions. You asked about, or you've seen units that are being built or renovated, and I guess I just wanted to clarify, number one, that Deanna mentioned that really isn't public housing. That's not a true subsidy where people are paying 30% of their gross adjusted income towards their rent. What more than likely you are seeing are tax credit projects. I'm certainly not an expert on tax credit projects and how they're developed, but those have a maximum rent, and I couldn't even tell you what those rents are. But a tax credit is affordable to the extent that the rents are going to be maintained below a certain threshold. A subsidized unit is one that the tenant pays 30% of their gross adjusted income towards rent, and a subsidy is provided towards them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Ms. Bergman, the other point might be, too, tax credits are privately owned as compared to publicly ownership of some of the other units.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. My question is for Ms. Bakken. When you talked about public housing program, you had said that in 2012, HUD had come in and raided your reserves and drastically reduced offsets, and it had a very, very big impact on the small agencies. And I thought I even heard you say something about that you had zero income from HUD. I can't fathom that. I can't fathom how you operate a program on zero income. Can you just speak to how did you manage that?
Spoken.
Madam Chair, we had big bake sales. No, I'm sorry. I apologize. Sorry about that. The determination as to how much subsidy you were going to get was based on your reserves. So for years and years, HUD said, here's your subsidy. We want you to put a little bit away for a rainy day as a savings account so that if you have a major maintenance issue, you can count on your capital funds, but you also will have this reserve. Secretary Donovan said, look at these reserves sitting out here. Maybe we can shave off some of the budget and use some of those reserves. So what they did is they looked at what your reserve level was, and if it was over, an example, 6 months, they looked at it and said, okay, well, you can afford to live off your reserves this year to a proportion of it. And some agencies received, and I represent three agencies. One agency received 100% of their subsidy, one agency receives 0%, and the other one receives 76%. So it was based on what your reserve level was, and those who received none had to live off of their reserves. So now we have no reserves left at those agencies that had some.
Okay. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this question is for either of you who could answer it. So in looking through, I understand you're able to issue bonds and use levies to fund certain aspects of your program, but do your agencies have the flexibility and ability to borrow funds privately from a bank or any other institution that would be willing to lend it to you to make improvements in case of situations like that where you do have a rainy day fund, as government raids do happen. And so if you do have that ability, is there any way that it could be better for you to, you know, make those choices individually, locally, in your own communities?
Ms. Bergman?
Madam Chair, Representative Metza, I'm going to start with, because it's really interesting, because the Brainerd HRA right now is talking about the possibility of doing a, we're going to make some energy improvements to our public housing. And one of the ways that we're able to do that is go out and get a loan borrow against our public housing and pledge the savings of our energy reduction to make payments on that loan. So, yes, we do have the ability to borrow funds from banks. The Brainerd HRA did borrow money against our property for another project within the community. So we have used those types of resources. We have also issued bonds for projects within our community, and we have, the Brainerd HRA has two tax increment financing districts that we've used for some downtown revitalization projects.
Madam Chair?
Spocken.
Representative Metza, the agencies throughout the state do a lot of their programs differently, and a lot of it's based on the local political atmosphere. Some of the agencies are very challenged with doing things outside of their public housing. A lot of the small agencies throughout greater Minnesota actually are small public housing agencies only, and the opportunities for paying back a loan are a challenge when you have when the government determines, okay, this is exactly how much you need to run your program, we're going to give you 80% of that. It kind of doesn't look like a really good opportunity to make a loan to us if that's our only source of income. And for a lot of agencies throughout the state, that is their only source of income. So while some agencies have additional opportunities, some are not exactly a good risk. And she was referring to I had it in my head as soon as you were looking for it, the energy performance contracts. And the energy performance contract is kind of a little bit of a different vehicle, and it's specifically designed to help provide different, it provides a savings in the energy, so therefore that's your return on it. But for a building need that's not going to be reaping the benefit, it's harder to get a loan for that. So it depends on where you're located and what kind of programs you run.
Thank you.
I have a question. Thank you. I have a question I wanted to ask you before. We've got just a couple minutes left, and I don't think I have time to ask all my questions. But so the federal fundings have been cut. You've been impacted by the state homestead exclusion program negatively. The reserves have been raided. And the maintenance funds are not available. I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you to help the committee understand is what the need is for rehab and repair to continue to preserve this housing. And one of the reasons I asked that is in our last year's bonding bill, I think we only gave $5 million towards what was then described as a $400 million need for just maintaining these buildings, the publicly owned buildings around the state. Where are we at with that now? That $5 million, I presume, was snatched up. And I know we have long waiting lists for people, so the idea of creating any new housing doesn't seem to be on the horizon. But just in terms of maintaining that housing, can you tell me a little bit more about what the need is right now?
Madam Chair, I guess first with the bond allocation for public housing rehab, which was greatly appreciated by the HRAs throughout the state of Minnesota. Those funds have been issued. There was $5.5 million available. There was more applications than there was funds to be able to fund. So those projects are off the ground. At least the funds have been allocated. I don't know if contracts are signed and work has started probably this spring. And then as far as what we're doing to continue to maintain our property, am I correct in your question?
The question is probably what the unmet need is yet.
The unmet need for rehab?
Rehab, maintenance, so those buildings don't deteriorate.
Again, our capital fund, we have seen, again, I'll go back to the Brainerd HRA, in 2009, our capital fund dollars were about $320,000, $325,000. In 2012, we got $185,000 for our capital fund to make improvements to our public housing. We do what we can and try to get our projects done as best as we can with the money that we have available to us.
Madam Chair?
Ms. Bakken?
Committee members, the agency was able to come up with a specific number based on a survey that was done of the capital needs at the time. It's not something that we continue to survey on a yearly basis, but it's something that we can definitely send out and get information on if you'd so approve.
Yeah.
We would love to get that information for you. The actual number is continuing to go down because of the partnership with the state money, the bonds that were provided. The federal program does continue to have an operating subsidy to public housing and a capital funds subsidy as well. So we get two pots of money, one of which is to take care of our capital needs and start chipping away at the iceberg. So the opportunities are continuing to funnel this direction, and we are chipping away at the iceberg, but I don't have a specific number, but it is going in the right direction, and we are working very hard to maintain our properties as best we can.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I know that's true in my own city and several other counties and city sponsored programs, so I appreciate that work. I do want to just ask, and I probably guess this might have to be for another time question, but you mentioned operating funds, and I know one of the issues that is, especially since so many of these public housing buildings are the people that live in them are seniors, persons with disabilities, very vulnerable people for the most part. Security is an issue, and I know that the operating funds, I assume, goes towards some of the security. Project Lookout, I know, in the city of Minneapolis, for example, has been devastated, so that security issues are really growing. And I'm just wondering what you might be able to tell us about that, or if that's something you can get back to me about statewide, how is that looking?
Madam Chair, if I may. Committee, the federal program used to have a specific program and a specific type of funding available to help with security issues. And they were geared at eliminating drugs and eliminating some of the concerns in some of the public housing. They also have authorized police officers to be living in the buildings in the subsidized units in exchange for some security type services. A lot of agencies have used their capital funds to put in security systems that are just cameras and such, and have worked with providing opportunities that a tenant who is concerned to be able to immediately contact the police department, and we've done some local education and working with our partners in our community as far as the police department, fire department, about coming out, keeping an eye and checking like that. But the federal program that used to exist no longer exists, and there's no funding for that anymore.
Okay, that's what I thought. Thank you. Committee members, we come to the end of our time. Representative Anderson has an urgent question.
No, just a comment. You mentioned that the homestead exclusion may have hurt low-income housing, and for another day then, if we could have an explanation as to how that would have hurt this type of housing, I'd certainly appreciate that.
Okay. We can always have these folks back. I'm aware that people have other committee meetings. So thank you very much, committee members, and thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Meeting is adjourned.